You know, we can't do anything about 6 months from now. We've got to go day by day.
If you don't like it, then you're welcome to leave. But that's the way that we do things around here.
We play in New Jersey, man, so there's going to be some chippiness, there's going to be some griminess, but we're leaving it within the line, and I'll take a team like that.
Once a Giant, always a Giant. For me, it's only a Giant.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of All In with Art Stapleton, a New York Giants podcast brought to you by the USA Today Network. I am your aforementioned host, Art Stapleton. We have entered week four of the NFL season, and for the Giants, it's dire straits. 0-3, boy, and this stretch that's coming up is going to be a hellish run for Joe Judge and company to try to get back into the division race and really try to find some sense of satisfaction or stem the tide, if you will. They're 0-3 for the second straight year. Obviously, in Joe Judge's first season, the Giants started 0-5. They ended up 6-10. But for a Giants fan base that has experienced a ton of losing, really the most losing in the NFL since 2017, I'll get into that in a moment. But there's a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, and we'll see how the Giants, if they can, kind of turn that around for their fan base. It's going to be a big challenge in New Orleans this weekend. We'll get into that in a second. On today's show, an interview I had with Graham Gano, probably the best Giants player over the first 3 weeks of the season. He's on the verge of some history. He's had a great year so far. And obviously, when you have a kicker who has a great year, it's probably says a lot about your offense and the lack of explosion. And that's what the Giants have had offensively. But I talked to Graham about a bunch of different things. Obviously, history, whether he believes in jinxes, and more to that in the interview. Also talked to him about being on both sides of walk-off field goals, because he's experienced the highs and the lows and the emotional toll that that can take. So he can really speak to that and what's in the mind of the kicker. Last 2 weeks, Dustin Hopkins, and then for the Giants this weekend, falling victim to Young Ho Koo at the end of the game at MetLife Stadium. Another devastating loss for the Giants. Then in our Behind Frenemy Line segment, Luke Johnson, the New Orleans Advocate and the Times-Picayune, great beat writer for the Saints. He'll give us the lowdown of what life after Drew Brees is like, Jameis Winston, and what the last month or so has been like covering the Saints really away from New Orleans after Hurricane Ida. And obviously our best wishes go to everyone down there in Louisiana having to deal with yet again a natural disaster and the fallout from that. We all remember Katrina, and here in New Jersey where I'm based, we remember Sandy. Obviously Ida took its toll on New Orleans, and we'll be heading down there this weekend. No one's ever going to question the resilience of the city of New Orleans. So as we go into this weekend for the Giants, you know, I've seen it written, you know, the honeymoon is over, quote unquote, for Joe Judge. And I'm not sure if this was really ever a honeymoon. I do think that it's very difficult for a fan base and really the media and anyone who's assessing the Giants to just treat this as Joe Judge's tenure. Because let's be honest, he's 6-13. He's had 19 games. Now, you would expect to be able to judge someone after 19 games, but you might need a little bit longer time. And the idea that here we are again, and there's some rumblings from outside the organization that, you know, is Joe Judge on the hot seat? I don't believe that's the case. But I do think that there needs to be some urgency here. And it's not that Joe Judge isn't showing the urgency behind the scenes, because I believe from everything I'm hearing that he is. It's a matter of publicly. And Judge is going to stay as even keel as possible, because he doesn't believe in sending a message to his team that there's panic, that the noise is proper of outside the organization, that things are in disarray. You know, I've seen that written also, that things are in disarray. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that either. I think the football right now is a problem, but I do not believe on the inside of that building that they feel as though this is just an extension of Ben McAdoo to Pat Shurmur and now to Joe Judge. But the only thing that's going to change that perception is going to be winning. And the Giants this weekend are certainly not favored to win. And that brings us to our friends at Tipico. Tipico Sportsbook, a global sports betting leader, is now live in New Jersey and Colorado. They've got the Giants underdogs by 7.5 to the Saints in New Orleans. Is that a game you want to bet this weekend? Well, make your favorite sports more interesting with Tipico's fast and easy mobile sportsbook app. For a limited time, new users from this podcast will enjoy a special welcome bonus. Terms and conditions apply, 21 and over. See site for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Get your bonus today at usatodaybet.com/podcast. That's usatodaybet.com/podcast. So when you come off the high of having Eli Manning as a guest last week, and again, thanks to Eli Manning for coming on, for really being as candid as he could and talking about all the things that, you know, I wanted to hear from him, his legacy, his family, and you know, beyond that, just the fun stuff about Seinfeld and pranks and everything else. It was as good as it can get. It was a home run. So when I was trying to figure out what guests to come on this week, you know, I tossed around a couple ideas, and the bottom line is Eli is always going to be the standard. And, you know, we had to follow Eli up with really what I felt as though was going to be an interview of substance. I wanted it to be timely with the Giants. You know, right now at 0-3, there aren't a lot of people talking a lot about how good things are. And, you know, I thought of Graham Gano because all of the emotion for the Giants the last couple weeks that we've seen, you know, the kick in the teeth finishes that they had in Washington and at home. Graham Gano did it to the Giants twice before he came here when he was a Carolina Panther. So he could speak to those emotions, both ends, being a captain. So I thought Graham Gano was a great person to bring on, especially with everything that he's got going on and the streak that he has. I think you'll enjoy this interview with Graham Gano. We did it on Wednesday, right after practice. And just as a quick aside, you know, we were on the patio behind the Giants facility by the practice fields, and it was during the media session. So during the interview, you may hear some scuttlebutt in the background. It's just other reporters waiting for other interviews at the podium at the Giants as Graham and I were sitting there and doing the podcast. So again, part of the real life, part of beat life. That's just the way it is. So I hope you enjoy the interview with Graham Gano. All right, it's time for my interview with Graham Gano, Giants kicker, captain this year. Graham, thanks for joining me. We're here getting ready for New Orleans week, coming off of Sunday. Beautiful day today. Right? This is really football weather. Right?
Yeah, it's great. We're starting to get a little chill in the air, which I'm sure comes quicker here than in most places. But yeah, definitely is good football weather today.
You know, you saw my cheat sheet with my questions about my first question. Is that, you know, I know when I'm sitting here talking to a kicker who's, we'll get to that in a second, made enough kicks in a row, but do you believe that something could be jinxed or superstitions or anything like that?
I honestly don't believe in it. I mean, you know, I think it comes down to practice and preparation. And I think, was it my snapper in Carolina, J.J. Jansen, used to say, I think it was from a show, he's like, I'm not superstitious, I'm, you know, a little stitious.
Yeah, that was The Office.
Yeah, it was The Office. He loved that show. But, yeah, I mean, some guys have superstitions. I tend not to believe in them because then I feel like you're believing in things that are, you know, out of your control. And you know, I'm very faith-based, and I feel like, you know, I've been given the talent and ability, and it's what you do with that. It's the hard work you put in and everybody around you. So I tend not to believe in that stuff, but I know a lot of people do. But I just try to, you know, do the same thing I'm doing and try to stay even keel and not get too high or not get too low.
Well, good. So then you're not going to blame me for the next question. But obviously, you're aware of it. People have talked to you about it. You've made a team record 37 field goals in a row dating back to last season. The fourth longest streak in NFL history. I mean, when you put it in that perspective, and then you throw in the idea that Adam Vinatieri has the record at 44. So, obviously, within range, I know you're kick to kick.
Mm-hmm.
But when did you first become aware of the run you're on? And even though it was dated back to last year, and
yeah.
What do you consider to be your secret to success right now?
I think, I usually end up hearing about it because folks like yourself ask me questions about them, and sometimes I don't really want to know, but at the end of the day, I'm like, well, you know, if you know, and like you were saying, I just go kick by kick, so I just try to take it one kick at a time. I mean, I understood last year, I think it was against Baltimore, we had a 40-plus yarder into the wind, and I knew that it was the kick to tie the record for the Giants. And so, you know, there's that in your mind, but at the same time, you have to block all that out and you know, just focus on doing what you need to do. You know, in that specific kick, the wind was in our face, so there's a few different things I had to do to try and make that kick. But and I think the next one was against Dallas or something like that at home. Right. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's harmful to know. I mean, I'm sure it'd be easier not to know, but at the end of the day, I mean, it's just something you just got to deal with. And, you know, I remember watching Adam with that record and how special that was. So the way I look at it, you know, if it happens, you know, that I end up getting up there, that's fine. And, you know, if not, I'll just start another streak. So that's kind of the way I look at things.
I guess any record that you would be attached to, similar to being mentioned with Adam Vinatieri,
yeah,
is always not a bad thing.
That's awesome. Yeah, he's one of the greats, and anytime, you know, you're in mentioned with his name, and I know, I think it's Gary Anderson's up there with 40, and he did it twice, which was, I thought was pretty cool. And I mean, there's, you know, countless guys that are up there, and I just think it's really neat to be able to be mentioned in the likes of those.
You look around the league, there are incredible kicks made seemingly every week. You were on the opposite sideline for back-to-back the last 2 weeks, mm-hmm, of walk-off kicks and the craziness down in Washington when that happened. You obviously beat the Giants not once but twice on walk-offs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is that like to be the opposing kicker, watching the guy lining up for
that? It's tough. It is kind of like a fraternity in the kicking world. I always say I never root against guys, like individual guys, you know, and their success. And I know biblically it talks about, you know, not wishing any, like, ill will on anybody anyways. But in those situations, at the end of the day, I want to win. And, you know, you want the team to win. So I wouldn't really say it's tough, because I want to win more than, you know, anything else, but you don't want to wish anything bad on the other guy as well. So it's hard, though. You wish it was the other way around. You know, I wish I was the one kicking the ball and not the other guys, but it just shows, you know, how close we are to winning those games. And it's I mean, I feel like that's the NFL. You know, everybody's good at this level, and you know, it's tough to see them go through, but, you know, it is what it is.
What, when it comes down to, you've been, like I said, you've been in those situations. You've kicked game-winning field goals as the clock hits zero.
Mm-hmm.
Speak to the emotions of a kicker in that spot. You know, sometimes you hear it's the loneliest spot to be, but that's kind of what you guys train for, right?
Yeah, for sure. You know, ever since I was a kid, been kicking a ball, and, you know, I loved scoring goals in soccer. I loved kicking field goals in high school, And I was mainly a punter in college at Florida State, but I still wanted to be the field goal kicker, because that's, you know, the guy that scores the points and that has those chances to win games. And it's kind of what you always dream of. So that's, you know, what I chose to pursue in the NFL. And you remember the game winners. You remember the ones you missed, and you learn from them. But, you know, I can remember in great detail all of them, and, you know, what I could have done better on the ones I've missed, and what went right on the ones I made. But yeah, those are the moments you dream of. It's a lot of fun. You want those moments, and there's so much excitement. But at the same time, you go out on the field, and I feel like that with the years I've been playing, it's kind of just like another kick. You know, you got to stay, I was saying earlier, you just got to stay even keel and not let your emotions get too high or too low. And I feel like that's why you see me on field goal on TV hit a field goal. I've just got, my face is just stoic. So I try to just stay in the moment and not let the emotions really get to me.
I assume you didn't. You obviously didn't see it live because you guys were just coming off the field. But what did you think about Tucker's? Justin Tucker's 66 yarder.
Unbelievable. So after the game, I usually look to see how my buddies have done, and Ryan Santoso was kicking for the Lions. So I saw the score. I think it was 19-17, and so I'm like, I wonder how he did. So I looked, and he had the go-ahead field goal with a minute left, and then I looked at the bottom. And it said Justin Tucker's 66-yard field goal, and I said, okay, that's got to be a typo. Because on was it on ESPN sometimes it'll say it's like a 46, it'll say it's a 56, you know, they add 10. And so I was like, that's got to be the case. And then sure enough, found out it wasn't. And I was not surprised. He and I, usually when we're kicking against each other, we go back and forth, you know, in warm-ups to see who can hit the furthest without really saying much to each other. But it's one of those, just, I guess, every time we kick against each other, we do it. But yeah, happy for him. That's a record that I've had my eye on for a long time. You know, I think every kicker does, and to see him hit a kick like that, knowing how rare those opportunities are, it's very exciting to see that.
They say you test him pregame, right, to see how far you were. I guess he had all of 66 yards on that kick.
Yeah, for sure. I read that he was short from 65 warm-ups, and he made a little adjustment. So it was cool to see as another kicker, you know, just have so much respect for that type of moment, because every single thing has to go right, and you know, it's exciting to be able to see that for him.
What's the kick you're most proud of?
Oh man, that's a tough one. There's been a lot of exciting kicks in my career. Dating back to high school, I still remember, you know, celebrating with the guys and all that. But we had a game against the Colts. It was actually against Adam Vinatieri, and I think I was the first kicker to hit two field goals in overtime, and Adam had hit, I think, a 50-yarder and in that game. And it was pouring rain, Monday Night Football. You know, the game went into the next day, so it was like Tuesday morning, and had a 52-yarder to win the game. So that was pretty memorable, is to keep us undefeated in Carolina. And I think just the moment, you know, is to keep the undefeated season going. You're going against the greatest kicker of all time, and it's pouring rain, you know, big time game. So that was probably my most memorable one.
That's great. Well, now I got to go to the other end of the spectrum. What's the worst feeling you've ever had after a missed kick?
My first game kicking on varsity in high school as a sophomore, and it was homecoming. And so they sent us out for a 45-yard field goal at the end of the game to win the game, homecoming for the school, and I was, you know, a young kid. And I hit this thing right down the middle, and I'm ready to celebrate, and it's going, hits the crossbar and bounces out. And so I'll never forget, my dad came up to me after the game, and he said, I want you to remember what this feels like right now. He's like, in your lowest moment, I want you to remember this. And he's like, remember every detail, because when the next opportunity comes and you make the kick, you're going to remember that, and it's going to make that moment that much better. So as terrible as of a moment it was at the time, you know, it ended up kind of shaping me and as a kicker, and I was thankful for it.
People see you now in your X money. How many years is this now?
I should have had this written 13, down. 21, kicking a ball though, kicking a football, I think. So.
But, you know, 13th, when you're in the NFL for this long, there's probably not an appreciation for the twists and turns of your career.
Mm-hmm.
And I know after the first year in Baltimore, right, you ended up in the United Football League,
yeah,
right, for the Las Vegas Locomotives, and your coach was the late Jim Fossil.
Yep.
I didn't know that until you posted really a poignant message about Jim Fossil this summer.
Yep.
What was that experience like for you that year? You guys ended up winning the championship.
Yeah, right? We did. We were training in Casa Grande, Arizona, basically the desert. We had sandstorms roll through practice, and the place that we stayed at was a Holiday Inn, you know, in town. And I mean, no kidding, there's Roadrunners, scorpions on the field. It was, you know, the whole nine yards. But it was so much fun. I mean, it was like another opportunity for me to be able to play the game, you know, I love. And Coach Fossil gave me the opportunity to do that, and gave me a lot of good opportunities during the season, believed in me. And you know, because of that league, I was able to get other opportunities after that. So I had so much to thank, you know, him for. But yeah, that league was so much fun. That's what I remember most, was how much fun we had as a team, and how much fun he made the game for us.
What's your best Fossil story? Do you have one?
Or
something that came
so
back?
So we had the league didn't have a whole lot of money. You know, we weren't paid a whole lot. And it was mainly a lot of guys that were still trying to make it into the NFL, or guys that had played in the league that just were playing for fun. And so I hit a kick in practice and hit the camera on the camera tower and just destroyed it. Pieces went flying. And I remember Coach Fossil coming up to me and saying, you know that's going to come out of your paycheck, right? And I didn't have much money at all. And I was thinking to myself, you got to be kidding. Like, I can't afford to pay for a camera. And he just starts laughing. He's like, I'm just kidding. We'll take care of it. You know, we got insurance for that type of stuff.
That's funny.
Yeah, he was a great man. And there's so many great stories I could tell about him. But, yeah, he's a great man. Had so much to thank him for.
And you kicked the game-winning field goal to win that championship, right?
We did. We were going against, the Florida Tuskers, I think it was, and it was a 33-yard field goal. And that was exciting, you know, for probably the tens of fans that we had in the stands. It was a good moment for us.
So I saw this yesterday. I had to bring it up to you. November 6th, 1869, the first football game. Rutgers and what is now Princeton, and the mm-hmm. first points were credited to S.G. Gonneau
and Dixon as well, with the same spelling as Riley here on our team.
Is there any relation? I mean, I've got to go way, way back, but yeah. Have you heard of any
relation? I think my dad did the, what do you call it?
The ancestry
type thing, and we are related. I think it's on like a different side of the family, but there is a relation, and I think the first person to show me that was my old coach, Bruce DeHaven. He passed away as well, but coached for the Bills for a long time. And, and he brought it up to me one day in Carolina and said, hey, would you look at this? And I couldn't believe it. So, yeah, it's pretty neat just to think the Gonneaus have been kicking for generations now.
The guy who had to wait to finally kick until his senior year of Florida State has a familial connection to the first points ever scored.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, but pretty neat. I've got that picture laminated in my house, and that's pretty cool.
All right, we're going to do the two-minute drill now. So one football question and three, like, fun, off-the-beaten-path questions. Football question, what is the toughest place you'd ever have to kick?
Toughest place to kick? I would have said Washington when I played there because it was pretty rough. And I could have kicked a lot better back then, but thankful for that. I'd probably say Buffalo.
Buffalo, what about it? Just
windy
conditions.
Yeah, it's probably just the wind. I mean, there's a handful of stadiums like that, but I thought that I was supposed to rattle these off, so I just picked Buffalo.
No, that's good. You could elaborate a little bit.
Yeah, it's a little windy. Chicago's tough. That might actually be the toughest. Tall grass, windy stadium. Cold weather, but yeah, there's a handful.
Did you ever kick in the old Giant Stadium? No, right?
I didn't. No, I think I came into the NFL the year after they built MetLife.
How would you compare MetLife to those?
It's windy. This past game was one of the windiest games I've kicked in here, or in general, really. And they said this was a lot like the old Meadowlands Stadium.
Gotcha.
Was this past game? I mean, I hit one field goal in warmups from 60 yards and hit the net. And then the very next kick from 65, I was 5 yards short in the end zone. So, I mean, that was 15, 20-yard swing in just one kick. So, yeah, it was breezy and had 50-yarders falling short in warm-ups. And, so that was it gets interesting at times.
All right, not that football isn't fun, but let's do the fun stuff. If you can go to one concert, whether it's an act that's still in existence, passed away, what would it be?
I would love to have seen Journey. Like back in the day, you know, when before their singer passed away. But, I would have really liked to have seen them live.
Have you seen them now?
I haven't. Yeah, I haven't had the chance yet. I think I'm not sure if they were here not too long ago.
Yeah,
but
I'm not sure. I know that I've seen things, stories about the lead singer who took over in Journey.
I think they found him on YouTube or something like that. Yeah, I'd like to check it out.
Anyone who watches The Sopranos is forever connected to Journey now with the Don't Stop Believing at the end. So
that's awesome.
If you're in New Jersey, you know Journey. What's the best meal you've ever had?
Anything my wife cooks.
I knew you were going to go that route.
That's right. I mean it. She's a fantastic cook. I love every meal. Every meal she's cooked.
Well, what's your go-to?
I'm sticking to it.
What's your go-to?
Shoot, there's a lot of things, but the thing that's popping in my head right now is chicken pot pie. Oh my goodness. I think it's just because I'm hungry and it's about lunchtime. But I haven't had that in a while, so I might have to, next time I'm home, see if she can make that.
Cool. And if you, this is, you know what, this is a silly question, so I'm going to skip it. I'm going to improvise and just go off of a question that I didn't ask you. Notice that you write on your knuckles before the game. When did that start? What do you write? Is it the same thing all the time?
It's funny. Not many people notice that. It's my wife's initials, and I've been doing it since I was in college, since sophomore year. And so there's been her initials have changed since then, and then I also write my children's initials. So okay. There's a lot on there, and then write 143 for I love you, gotcha. For the number of letters in each word. But yeah, I've been doing it ever since. So for a while, I was thinking I was running out of room after our fourth and fifth kid. But yeah, I've done that ever since college, and don't plan on stopping.
Awesome. Well, see, for a guy who doesn't believe in jinxes and is not necessarily superstitious, you have some routines that you stick to.
Yeah, there's some routines I stick to. I wouldn't call them superstitions. You know, there's been times I've forgotten to do things here and there, and it, I mean, it's just whatever. You know, you forget, and you just try to remember next time.
Graham Gano, the only thing I ask you when you get down to New Orleans, that first kick, put it through the upright so I don't have to hear, oh, you know, he went on the podcast all in.
No, it wouldn't be your fault anyways. It's my job to make them, and you know, I just try to do my best.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, obviously, the rest of the season. Always look forward to covering you, and good luck in New Orleans on Sunday.
All right, I appreciate it. Go Giants.
So as I said, thanks a lot to Graham Gano for joining me. And, you know, I love some of these interviews. I want to give the Giants fan and listeners of All In just a glimpse of who these players are, not just currently what they're doing now. But I think they all have great stories to tell. And, you know, I try to be as much a storyteller in the interviews for the podcast as I would you know, on the pages of The Record or on the pages of NorthJersey.com and USA Today Network. So hope you enjoyed that from Graham. I thought a lot of it interesting. How about that connection to the birth of college football, huh? Rutgers and Princeton and having a guy named Gano account for the first points. And it turns out that his father was able to kind of trace the roots and find out that they're a distant cousin. Pretty crazy. So thanks again to Graham. For our Behind Frenemy Lines segment, I reached out to Luke Johnson and a couple other reporters for the Saints, to be quite honest, and they've had a heck of a month down there. So Luke was gracious enough to join me. And what I wanted to find out from him was not just a sense of where the Saints are right now, sitting at 2-1. They blew out the Packers in the season opener. Then they end up losing to the Panthers, and then they beat the Patriots up in Foxborough. But what is the feel for this team? Where are they at? And obviously, we had to touch on the emotions of Sunday and what the Giants are walking into. Over 600 days, Saints fans have waited to pack the Superdome, which was an impossible place for the Giants that had winning teams to go in there and play. And now Joe Judge has to take this team at 0-3 and kind of a lot of questions surrounding different spots on this team and go down there in New Orleans. So I think you'll like Luke's interview and have at it and enjoy my time with Luke Johnson of the New Orleans Advocate and the Times-Picayune. All right, it's All In with Art Stapleton, and it's now time for our Behind the Frenemy Lines segment. This week's guest, Luke Johnson, Saints beat writer for the New Orleans Advocate and Times-Picayune. Luke, it's been a wild 3 weeks starting for the Saints. We'll get to that later, but welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. It's nice to put a voice to an online persona. I think we followed each other on Twitter for a couple of times. I've never actually had a chance to talk to you, so it's nice doing that here.
Absolutely, and I think the last time the Giants and the Saints hooked up down in New Orleans was the 52-49 masterpiece / disaster debacle for the Giants when Drew Brees threw for, what, 107 touchdowns against the Giants that day and they won the game?
Yeah, I think that's about right. Now, I remember when we were putting together our Drew Brees retrospective stuff at the end of the year, a lot of us ended up going back to that game as one of his career highlights. An absolutely insane game by both him and Eli. I kind of don't expect we'll see something like that on Sunday, but I will gladly tell you if we can get one like it.
Boy, I tell you, if somehow Jason Garrett and the Giants offense can do that this weekend, I think Giants fans might be probably passed out by the third quarter if that somehow happened. So let's
talk...
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk. Three games into life without Drew Brees, and I know everyone in New Orleans was kind of dreading that day for years. What has it been like not having Drew, just his presence around this team? And I know right now it's 3 weeks into a season, but even through the summer and not having Brees in attendance, what kind of different feel did it give to the Saints?
You know, I'm not really sure it actually was that much different. I don't want to take anything away from Drew and what he meant to the team as a leader. I think the biggest thing has been his influence on like the game day atmosphere, right? And just that knowing it has the confidence in like a quarterback, like in a 2-minute scenario or something like that. Like getting that confidence on the team was huge. And there's so many little. Like Drew had his tendrils in like every single little part of the offense, and people the last couple of years they're just talking about him and his arm strength and how they don't have the deep threat anymore, and how that's, you know, once they get a quarterback in there who can launch it downfield, they'll be all right. And then they see, you know, week two when Jameis is getting sacked or pressured on every other play, they're like, oh, hey, well, you probably missed that with Drew, and then you probably missed this with Drew, and then the other thing, and all these little areas that you just didn't realize he had this huge impact in that he did. But as far as like the actual like atmosphere on the team, I think they're still so loaded with experienced players and players who command a lot of respect that I don't think there was as much of an impact of in that phase from losing a guy who played 20 years in the NFL and commanded a ton of respect around the league as there would have been other places, because they still have Demario Davis and Cam Jordan and Malcolm Jenkins, the guys who've been in the league 10 plus years on the defense, and then in the offense, Teron Armstead and Alvin Kamara, just guys who are just well established leaders on team. I think that really helped them navigate that. Plus, yeah, Sean Payton's been here forever. Alvin Kamara was like a middle schooler when Sean Payton started this job. I think just from a locker room culture standpoint, they didn't lose as much as a lot of other places would when you're talking about a quarterback of Drew Brees' stature leaving the team.
Gotcha. Let's stick with the quarterback, and obviously Jameis coming in, he's gotten a lot of national attention, but from your perspective, what have you seen as the biggest reason for the success he's had so far?
Well, I think for the most part, he's done a really good job of just doing what they're asking him to do, which hasn't been much. I think through 3 weeks, they've got 64 pass attempts, which is like 10 less than Tom Brady had last week against Rams.
Right.
You know, they are just they're playing a very conservative approach offensively, and they're asking him to make the plays that are available for him, to not be careless with the ball, and that's about it, right? And there's been a couple plays that he's made that have been he makes it, and you're like, well, that's hasn't been here in the offense for a while. And they're doing this without Michael Thomas, without Tre'Quan Smith, who your listeners probably don't know who he is, but he's a key part of their offense as like a third receiver and as a blocking receiver. They're with their starting center, who's a very, very good young player, Eric McCoy, and now they're looking at being with Teron Armstead. So I don't think they want to put too much on Jameis's plate yet. Then there's also been some plays where you look at him and you're like, the first thing out of your mouth is same old Jameis, right?
Right.
And it's probably unfair to him because that's what people are looking for. But it's been obvious when it happens. A couple times it's worked out in their favor. He's had two touchdown passes where he's thrown it, fallen off his back, but like literally fallen down with a guy draped all over him. He just kind of threw a jump ball up, and both times his receivers caught it. And then there's been a couple more where he's thrown it deep downfield in the same sort of deal where he's fallen down or he's on the move, you know, and he's thrown it into coverage and it's not even close and it's an interception. I think those plays are probably they're probably not going to push those out of him. I think this is really just who he is at times, and you got to live with it. But I think at some point they're going to have to live with it while they're also getting more of the explosive benefits of Jameis Winston, because we've seen it throughout training camp that he really is a talented player, and they're kind of asking him to kind of play with a governor right now. But at some point, they're going to need him to go out and let it rip. And I think it's come at some point. I just don't know when. They've just been very, very conservative with him.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the Giants in week one going against the Broncos, it was in the preseason, or at least, you know, before Teddy Bridgewater was given that job or won that job. The idea was, well, the Giants defensively might be better off against Drew Lock because he's going to put the ball up and maybe get some chances. It sounds like, you know, going into this week, Giants fans who are still have hope, which there aren't many at 0-3, to be honest, are hoping that Jameis comes out and is Jameis from his Tampa Bay days where he's throwing the ball all over. I would imagine, like you said, the Saints are what Alvin Kamara is, right? I mean, they're going to ride Kamara, and that would lead me to my next point of how different are they using Kamara this year without Breeze and Michael Thomas, like you mentioned, or is it the same old Kamara that we've come to really appreciate even outside of fantasy?
Yeah, I mean, they've been using him heavily. It's been a big change, actually, this year. They're really treating him like kind of a bell cow back. You know, he's had two games with 20-plus carries so far, and I think he only had one of those in his first four seasons combined. So they're really, really leaning hard on their game. I think they feel very confident in that. They know that's kind of where their bread is buttered. They have a very good offensive line, and I think they have a very good offensive line, even down two very good starters.
Yeah.
They've just developed guys really well, and they coach them really well. Their scheme is really sound, and they're really confident in just sticking with it. I mean, last week, I think Kamara had touches on 10 of their first 15 offensive plays. And a lot of those were just, you know, they're outside zone, and you know, trying to set up third and short and let Jameis get that. So that's been the big difference. We haven't seen him go off for like a really big game yet. I think that's because without Drew here, without Michael Thomas here, opposing defenses have just been completely locked in on him and just saying, you're not going to let you beat us. And in some cases it worked. Carolina absolutely shut him out of that ball game. I think he had like 30 total offensive yards. And you know, he didn't have a huge game against either Green Bay or New England, but he had a big impact in the game from what the Saints wanted them to do. That's, you know, they wanted to control the ball and they wanted to kind of grind the defense out, wear it out, and then let their defense go out and win a game. So that's kind of what we've seen so far. And if they look at this passing offense opened up the way I kind of anticipate it will at some point, I think you're probably going to see Kamara explode for a couple of huge games because he'll finally have some room to operate.
You know, all the talk about the offense, and you mentioned the big names, really the big personalities on this team, big players are on the defensive side of the ball. DeMario Davis, as you mentioned, Cam Jordan, Marshawn Lattimore, those guys, is this defense kind of overlooked, do you think? I mean, I don't know if you could watch what they did to the Packers in week one and overlook this defense, but it seems to me that, you know, there's a method to Sean Payton's madness. You play conservative a little bit on offense because you know how good your defense can be. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think this defense is overlooked, and I think it's perennially overlooked, and that's a byproduct of how good their offense has been over the years. Sean Payton and the Saints have completely built their reputation on that, and the defense has kind of just been, you know, there. Some years it's been there in a bad sense, but lately, you know, these last probably four seasons, they've been pretty consistently a top 10 defense. Last year they were a top 5 defense, and I think they can beat that again this year. I mean, they've got studs at every single level, and Sean Payton knows that. You know, Sean Payton knows that he's got three really good defensive ends, and he's got one of the best three middle linebackers in football, and their secondary, top to bottom, is very, very good. They've got really, really good players at all 5 starting positions there. So, yeah, I mean, he's been relying on those guys to go out and shut down the opposing team and to create turnovers like they did against both Green Bay and New England. And oftentimes they've been playing with a short field on offense. Yeah, one of their touchdown drives, they started at the 9-yard line against New England. They had a couple of those against Green Bay, too. So they haven't needed to go out and swing the ball around the yard because their defense was kind of controlling the ball game from that side of things. And they're like, okay, well, let's just play keep away on the other side and then put a couple points on the board and win a game that way. I think probably the strength of this Saints defense is in its front. They've been playing some kind of those NASCAR packages with three defensive linemen on the field and three defensive ends rather. They've been using Tano Passanio as a interior rusher in those kind of third and long situations, and then they put their base linebacker, their sub package linebackers on the field. So it's been like DeMario Davis and rookie Pete Werner, and then C.J. Gardner-Johnson, their outstanding nickelback, is essentially a linebacker. It doesn't look like it. He's only about 205 pounds, but he's so physical, consistently making plays behind the line of scrimmage. This past week, he just somehow bull rushed the Patriots' right tackle and knocked him on the ground. He's just really, really strong. That's an alignment that has really worked for him. And they've just been really solid. Even in the game against the Patriots, the Panthers, they were on the field for like 45 minutes in that game. Yeah. The offense that only ran like 40 plays, the Saints offense did. And I think they still played pretty well in that game, despite the fact they were down like six starters. So really, really good defensive football team. I think that's going to be kind of the identity of this team by the end of the season. It's going to be what they're known for.
Well, I know what the city of New Orleans is known for, and that's resiliency. I don't think anyone will ever question that. We talk offense, we talk defense, obviously special teams down there in New Orleans as well, but there's that X factor. And for the first time in 657 days, the New Orleans fans will pack that dome and have a chance to root on the Saints. That atmosphere, what are the Giants walking into on Sunday?
Yeah, I kind of feel bad for Daniel Jones and company right now. That's going to be really, really hard, I think. People here are really looking forward to this, man. Look, New Orleans has kind of been, it was one of the early hot spots. And it probably doesn't mean anything to people up in New York. I know how bad it was up there, but it was pretty bad down here early too, after Mardi Gras. We've been kind of in lockdown for a significant chunk of this past year. This is one of the main things people look forward to throughout a year. And really, I think the biggest crowd they had in the Dome last year was like 7,000. So they are absolutely, they cannot wait for this. And the fact that they've had to wait an extra 3 weeks to go out there and get in the Superdome, people are ready, man. And it is going to be just an insane environment in there on Sunday. I guarantee it. And it's going to be very, very loud and probably very hard to communicate for the Giants. So I'm expecting that, and I am almost guaranteeing that it is going to be insane in there.
So I'd be remiss, and I really appreciate your time. It's Luke Johnson from The Advocate and the Times-Picayune. My last question to you would kind of be a little bit of a personal one, and I know we talked about it slightly before we got on the show. Give me a sense of what this past month or so has been, not just from the Saints, but covering the Saints for people you know in the city, family, yourself. In the aftermath of Ida, I don't think anyone could prepare for something like that, but certainly you guys have been through it down there a number of times. What is the emotions of actually, you're back home finally for the really the first time extensively. What's it been like, and how have you guys made it through?
Yeah, so I mean, the hurricane hit. A lot of people here left town. Basically, all my really good friends, and a lot of family were out of here, right? I think people have kind of been through that before, and they've seen they've seen what a really, really big storm that was kind of coming right up the gut can do. I don't think anybody wanted to mess around with it. So a lot of people left town. My wife and I actually stayed here. She was coincidentally covering the storm for the New York Times. She's a journalist here too.
Wow.
And so we stayed for the storm, and it was pretty gnarly down here. And then day after the storm, we'd obviously lost power, and there was the city was like, okay, well, we're looking at like probably a couple weeks without power. And so we decided to get out of town. At that point, the Saints had already left for Dallas. So my wife and I packed up, and we took our two dogs to a tiny little hotel room in Pensacola, Florida. Thank you, Marriott, for the points there. Went from there to Memphis, Tennessee, which is about 7 hours away, to like a farmhouse. Covered the team remotely for a week. And then the Saints were saying, like, okay, well, we're still going to be here in Dallas for a while, potentially up to a month. So I went across to Dallas, another like 7-hour drive, covered the team there for a couple weeks. And then the team, you know, we were in Dallas, so I went from Pensacola to Memphis to Dallas. And then they said, well, we're not going to play our home game in New Orleans because, you know, stuff's not ready there yet. So then flew from Dallas to Jacksonville, back to Dallas. Week two was in Charlotte, flew to that game and came back. And then the Saints were in COVID protocol. So thankfully they had, for me, for my sake, they had they switched everything to remote. So I was able, once I landed from Charlotte, drove 7 hours back to New Orleans, participated in Zooms for a couple of days, and then flew to Boston. And the team has just been living out of a hotel for a month, right? I feel like those guys had it much worse, and then much worse than either me or the team, or all these people who are, especially in Southeast Louisiana, like these little parishes in the coastal part of the state, have just absolutely wrecked. You know, people are still living out of temporary housing down there. I mean, it's been crazy. It's been absolutely nuts. I've never experienced anything like this. We got through it. I got through it. The beat got through it. The Saints got through it. Everybody's home and very, very happy to be here. It's been a long month. I think the Saints, if you're giving them all a truth serum right now and asking them if they were happy to be 2-1 after going through, you know, kind of a month from hell, I think they'd all be very, very happy, ecstatic to be where they are right now. So, been a while, man. I'm glad to be sleeping in my own bed and be back in this 90 degrees and 100% humidity, miserable weather down here. I actually somehow missed it after a couple weeks away.
I could only imagine. I mean, it speaks to the spirit of the city. And like I said, the resiliency we saw at Katrina, and obviously now coming back from Ida, you know, all the best to everyone down there. Like you said, just because some areas look like everything's back to normal, I'm sure there are still some people suffering. So obviously all the best out there. And I really appreciate your time. In 20 minutes, this has been great. Like you said, it's a little better than, you know, direct messages on Twitter. On Twitter, follow Luke, buy Luke Johnson. Great coverage down there of the Saints. Obviously, Sean Payton still has, you know, Giants ties down there. And, Luke, listen, great job as always. I appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing you on Sunday.
It sounds good, Art. Let me know if you need any recommendations for food. I got you covered down here.
I covered a Super Bowl down there, so I think I'm still full from the week that I spent down in New Orleans. But absolutely, I will be in touch.
All right, man. Sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to Luke for his time, and obviously all our thoughts for everyone down in Louisiana. I'm eager to get down there this weekend. I have to be honest, I'm a little apprehensive to see certain parts of the city. I know the fighting spirit, and I know the resiliency of trying to get everybody back. But sometimes, you know, I remember after 9/11 being up here in New Jersey and New York, and obviously after Sandy, the idea of while life moves on and everyone kind of has to move forward, there are still reminders of what transpired and some of the real hard lessons that people are forced to endure. So again, thanks to Luke, and looking forward to catching up with him more on Sunday down in New Orleans. So as we mentioned in the open, Tipico Sportsbook has the Giants as 7.5-point underdogs down in New Orleans. And to be honest, I'd be surprised if it's that close. You know, I had the Giants winning both in Washington, which they covered. I had the Giants winning against the Falcons, and they did not. So this weekend, I have the same. I don't think you can go against the Saints in this spot. The Giants are really going to start their fourth left guard in as many games, because Ben Bredesen has a hand injury that's likely to keep him out at least several weeks. What will the Giants do up front to combat the Saints' defensive front? As you heard Luke say, the defensive mentality for the Saints is to attack and be aggressive. Maybe Daniel Jones is a little bit more active in the RPO game and the read option, which was non-existent against Atlanta. I think maybe they have some moments, but this is a game that the Giants' best players need to step up for them to have a chance. They need to do more. They need more from Saquon Barkley. They need more from Logan Ryan, Leonard Williams, Kenny Golladay. You know, these are guys that need to step up and perform at a high level. James Bradbury. you know, the Saints don't have Michael Thomas. They're not out there throwing weapons down the field. Jameis Winston is going to be conservative, you would think, anyway, as Luke told us. So I think it's a matter of they're going to need some of these stars to really step up and make game-changing plays. They're talented enough. They just haven't done it yet. And I don't know if you can have confidence that they're going to go into this atmosphere, this building, these emotions for this fan base and be able to have a shot to beat the Saints. So, unfortunately, I think the Giants will be heading to Dallas, as will I, and they'll be 0-4. And I would think the circle, the inner circle for Joe Judge and the Giants will get smaller and smaller as we head back into the division for next week in Dallas. But as I've said all along, I really appreciate everyone engaging with this podcast and listening. Our numbers continue to grow. The Eli episode, again, we doubled all the downloads and listens from the previous week. So that was tremendous. Tremendous job across the board by everyone involved. Paul Wood, Dave Rivera, and Sean Oates. It's kind of our brain trust for this podcast. Want to thank them for all they put in. Want to thank you for your engagement. And like I said, and I've said every week, when you commit yourself to a team, you go with the highs and the lows. I can feel the pain of a fan base. I can feel the emotions, the anger. And really, for the Giants, the worst part about it is there is some apathy. But stick with it. I promise you, you are going to get the best coverage that you can get from me of the New York Giants and where they're going. And we're going to get there together because we're all in.